Dhamma talk. And I thought today I'd talk about letting go of expectations. So that's the end of the Dhamma talk. No expectations. Okay. I'll have to give some sort of Dhamma talk. So, continuing on a little bit from what I was talking about yesterday about the Satipatthana, four focuses of mindfulness, as I call it, and it's always associated with insight factors. So, today I want to talk more about insight. It's talking about the very same thing, because unless you have calm, you will never have much insight. And one of the similes which I heard, it wasn't from Ajahn Chah, it was from another monk, but I cannot remember whom now. In the forest monasteries of Thailand and also Sri Lanka and Burma, you may have visited there, and you know that we don't have nice concrete paths for all the little millipedes to walk on. I don't know why they use our paths. They've got many paths in the forest, but they tend to use our paths instead. But in those jungles, it wasn't the millipedes you were afraid of. It was the snakes. And I was told when I first went to Thailand, it's probably the same in Sri Lanka and Burma, they said there's roughly 100 different species of snake. 99 of those 100 are venomous. If they bite you, you're in big trouble. And the other one strangles you to death. So in other words, they're all really dangerous. And there's not those as well. They had these psychopathic centipedes in Thailand who would just go and attack you for no reason whatsoever. And then there was the ants, the biting ants, and goodness knows what else, creeping, the centipedes, the tarantulas. And everything out there looked at you as their dinner. So, it was very dangerous. So, because of that, you would see the monks and whoever else was there, the novices, sweeping the paths every day. And we have to sweep the paths every day, because then they became like white ribbons in the forest. And if there's anything crawling across it, you could see it. So it wouldn't bite you. It's just like health and safety. So, you know, you spend hours sweeping those paths of the leaves and the twigs. And you know what it was like. You sweep the path, and then there'd be a sudden breeze, and all these leaves will fall right behind you. And so you try and go sweep those off, and then the leaves on the front of the path would start falling. It was an endless job if you were a perfectionist, like I used to be. After a while, we said, oh, okay, just one or two leaves, doesn't matter. So you're just going to let them fall behind, you just sweep ahead. But the simile was, once you have a clean, swept path in those monasteries, one leaf would fall down on that clean, swept path, and you could see it clearly. You could see its shape, its size, its color, because it was one single leaf on a clean, swept path. And that was a wonderful simile for insight. If a leaf falls in the forest where there are thousands of other leaves, it doesn't stand out. You can't really get enough perspective and clarity to really understand it and examine it. But when it's a single leaf falling on a clean, swept path, it stands out, it's clear, and you have a much greater possibility of penetrating its nature. So, you all know that simile now, you can understand its meaning. If any thought or emotion comes up in the tangled forest and jungle of your mind, there's so many other stuff going on there, you can't really examine it because it's just totally overwhelmed by so much other stuff. But if your mind is nice and calm and peaceful, hardly any thought or emotion coming up, just so still, then one thought, one emotion arises, just like a leaf on a clean, swept path. And then you can pretty much understand it. You can examine it and contemplate it because you can get the perspective. It's not all confused with all the other stuff which is going on. And I thought that's a very wonderful simile of how the insight just really depends on a lot of stillness. Too many leaves in the forest and you can't understand which leaf is what. But when one leaf falls on a clean swept path, then you've got some understanding of it. But how do you understand it? And you know what I said to you the other day? It's not thinking about it. Because thinking is always old knowledge. And one of my sayings is that never allow your knowledge, your learning, to stand in the way of truth. Because that's what happens sometimes. You know, you look at something, so it's not supposed to be like that. It's not what I was taught. It's not what it says in the books. It's not just, you know, what I expected to be, but it's right there in front of you. So sometimes you're learning what you expect, what you want to happen, what you expect to see. This actually stops you actually becoming wise. So that's one of the reasons why the insight, we have to put aside all our old knowledge. We have to let go of the past. Totally. So don't think, I'm an expert in Buddhism. I have got a PhD in Abhidharma studies. I am a great monk. Put all that aside. Because otherwise, all that you've learned, all that you've been taught, will stand in the way of what's actually real right in front of you. So to get that insight, you have to also be so quiet that all those old ideas fade away. In science, it was like I was taught, when you do an experiment, just collect the data. Don't try and interpret what it means. Because if you do, then you'll tend to skew the data. Things which don't agree with, you know, what you think should be happening, you tend to sort of, you know, rub them out, delete them, fudge the results, as we used to say. You know, because you want to prove what you expect to see. And that's not wisdom at all, that's not insight. So, it's great if you're a scientist, you collect all the data first of all. You don't worry about what's supposed to happen, all your learning, and all the stuff in the book. You just collect the data, just with a silent mind, almost like you have let go of the past. And you just see what data is here, and you just collect that. And only afterwards, when all the data is in, then you can draw your graphs and get your conclusions and find out, you know, the wisdom of what you've been seeing. But not while you're seeing it. You have to be very silent to collect the data and not interfere with it. Which is one of the other reasons why that silence of the mind is so important if you are going to get some real insight in life. So often you think, this can't be true. And so you just deny it and push it away. So many people get these nimittas, say, in the meditation. And you think, no, I can't be a nimitta. Not me. I've only just started meditating. Maybe those nuns, they get nimittas all the time, but not me. And that just idea just blocks the nimittas from developing. Just suspend all of your learning, what you think is possible, what you don't think is possible. Suspend it all and just see what happens. That's the only way we can really get insight. So, you know, when we start saying that you have to be able to let go of the past and you have to abandon the future, that is so important, not just for stillness and nice meditation states, also for understanding stuff. Because it may not be, well, you know, what you are taught, of course, is perfectly accurate. It's, you know, the best teaching you can possibly get because you're getting them from the most humble monk in the world. But even if they are true, how many times do you misunderstand it? I told this to a monk a long time ago. He said, don't believe what I say. And he believed me. Well, that time, what, he didn't believe what I was saying. You know, you believe what I'm saying again, aren't you? So put that all aside. And instead, let the past go. So that means you can be open to seeing things you've never seen before. And there are two types of insight. Now, there's the first insight into the insight in how to meditate. Oh, actually, the insight into ordinary life, an insight into how to meditate. And the third type of insight, three types of insight, is the insight into nature of existence, the stuff which gets you enlightened. And all those insights are really helpful. And the first insight, how to get on in life, that is really, really helpful for most people. And that's where I get most of the donations from, writing books like Open the Door of Your Heart and Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. And that title, Don't Worry, Be Grumpy, that was a bestseller, number three in Germany. That book, of all the books, is an amazing success. And Don't Worry, Be Grumpy, you know where that came from. Just insights into ordinary life which actually help with your meditation. There was one lady here on one of the retreats, and about this time in the retreat, 4 or 5 days into the retreat, she came to the interview and said, I'm really fed up, I want to leave. I said, why? She said, everybody's happy and they're smiling, and we're supposed to be happy, and I feel miserable. I feel really grumpy, and I don't fit into this place. I just can't be happy. Because, you know, sometimes we call it like happiness retreats. Or, don't worry, be happy, just, doesn't matter if you're not getting good meditation, just smile, hug a teddy bear and be happy. And that really pissed her off. Because she just did not want to be happy. So, what I did, you know where I give the interviews, next door is the office. So I quickly went on the office, quickly turned on the computer, very quickly typed up the very first, the original grumpy license, which was on a monastery letterhead, and I got a nice Gothic script. You know, it's very easy on a computer, whatever script you like, nice Gothic script, so it really looked like a proper certificate, you know, given by a university or by some great institution. And there it was, grumpy license, on the top. This license, this certificate, gives the bearer, and it's Veronica, permission to be grumpy at any time, for any reason or no reason whatsoever, whenever she wants, sign. And at that time it wasn't Ajahn Donut, it was HR Ajahn Brahm. You know what HR meant? His roundness. Well, some people say his holiness or his highness, but I thought his roundness was more apt. His roundness, Ajahn Brahm. And I signed it for her, dated it and gave it to her. The very first, because, you know, she respected me. And so, you know, her teacher, the one she respected, gave her permission to be grumpy. So she didn't need to fight it anymore. So when I handed it to her, she had this huge smile on her face. She was happy. Once she had permission to be grumpy, then she was happy. Problem solved. So these are important insights into how to live our life. If you want to be grumpy, go ahead. If you want to be miserable, you have my permission. Honestly, be happy to be miserable. Then you can't be miserable anymore, can you? It's really interesting. Just when we fight the reality, that's what makes us upset and miserable. Not the misery itself. It's not wanting to be miserable. That's the trouble. Now, those are the great insights into life, which means that even here on this retreat, stuff happens to you, and oh, you just let it go, because you can be happy to be miserable. You don't have to struggle so much. So those insights into ordinary life, they are powerful. And some of those insights, you know that psychologists use them. Honestly, this was really weird. You know, I invent a lot of this stuff. And it's amazing that I was in Singapore, I was at a conference, and one of the presenters was showing some of the latest psychology techniques coming from the world, how to overcome your problems, you know, different ways of doing it. And on one of these videos, they had this, he was from Sydney, and he said, okay, the reason why people have these problems in life is not the problem, it's your perspective. And he got his hand and put it in front of his face and said, it's not the problem is your hand is too big, you've got it right in front of your eyes. If you put it where it belongs at the end of your arm, then yeah, the problem hasn't diminished at all, it's still the same size, But now you've got perspective, you can see it in relationship to everything else. And I was laughing, and a lot of other people were laughing, because they've heard that from me about 20 years ago. That's one of my sayings. But it's wonderful that, you know, it can actually get passed on. Or that other simile, which I was really laughing at this one. I was at a ceremony in Perth. It was the, actually it was about, oh, and it was the last full moon. It was just a few days ago. The full moon of November in Thailand is Loy Krathong. You know, that's where they put all these boats with candles in, on the river. And anyway, so they couldn't do that on the river here, but at least they had a ceremony for the day. So, you know, being a senior monk, I was invited along just for the part of the ceremony. And we get all the VIPs coming to give their talks. And the local MP for Perth, she came to give her talk. And I was almost falling off my chair laughing during her talk. This was only about 2 years ago. That's Eleni Evangelini or something like that. Anyway, she's a local MP for Perth. And she came up and she said, you know, all the blessings from, you know, the, I think she's a Liberal, from the Liberal government, you know, on this wonderful occasion. And she said, I just heard from a wise man, she said. It wasn't me, it was somebody else down the track. He said, the problem with stress is not just how much work you have to do. It's like the simile of a cup, she said. It's not the fact the cup is heavy, it's because you hold it too long. If you just put it down for a few seconds and rest, and you pick it up again afterwards, it feels lighter. And you see me do that so many times here. But it's great that it sort of, you know, it goes around and around and actually gets to places. So I really bailed her up afterwards. That's your straight away of saying, just go and confront her. And so I said, that's my simile. I invented that. At the very least, you should, you know, give an acknowledgement. I don't expect any, was it royalties, but an acknowledgement. It was really good fun. But now, where did all those techniques come from? I've never had a degree in psychology. I just had a degree in theoretical physics, and that's not, you know, much psychology. That's all just suck doing sums. But where all that wisdom comes from is because you know how to be silent and still and innovative. You get insights just from ordinary life, just by learning how to be quiet. Well, that other one which I've been making a lot of headway with, because again, you come on, I'm saying this now because this will stop a lot of those questions on the interviews. Again, this morning there's a whole list from the every slot filled for this morning's interviews, and I like a nice rest. I'm a lazy monk. If I can get out of doing an interview, I will. So, I like to say a few of the things which I say in interviews so you don't need to come anymore, because people always... I think about decisions. I've got so many important decisions to make in life, especially when I go home. Should I stop my job and get another job? Should I marry this guy? Should I get divorced from the guy I'm with already? You know, what should I do in life? What decision? And it was so easy for me to get the insight into decision making. It's so obvious when you actually see it. It doesn't matter what decision you make. To go left or go right, that is not important at all. We put so much effort into worrying and thinking and researching and asking other people's opinions, should we go left or should we go right? That's just a metaphor for a decision in life. I said, it doesn't matter. Don't put all that effort and worry into making the decision. Save all that energy for after you've made the decision. And then, if you go left, make sure the left path works by then putting all the energy and effort into making that decision successful. If you go right, then put all the energy into making the right path the correct path. So it doesn't matter in life which way you go, but what really does matter is once you made the decision, really putting all the effort into making it work. So easy then. So you don't have to worry about making decisions at all. It's not that important. Even if it's a matter of life and death, that's not important. You know, if it's a matter of life and death and you choose the wrong death, all you do is just, you accelerate people's reincarnation. It's not such a bad deal. So, you know, people take life and death far too seriously these days. So, instead, we can make decisions very easily without worrying so much. When we take the worry out of life, you know, a lot of people just have much more peace and happiness. So first of all, we do use the insights of insight meditation in just the getting by in ordinary daily life. So we're not so tired and worn out when we come to places like retreats. And when we do come here, we don't have to carry all that baggage, you know, from our past. And all that worry about our future, what decisions we will have to make in the future. So that way, we can actually clear our path a little bit more. So when little leaves fall, we can see them far more clearly. So, but the second part of insight is what's more relevant on this retreat, and the insights into how to be happy, or how to be peaceful, how to be silent. So we use whatever mindfulness we can to make sure that we understand how to meditate. Because meditation is such an easy thing to do if you understand how to do it. And it doesn't take willpower. It doesn't actually take that much skill. It certainly doesn't take effort. All it takes is learning how to let go. And what can be easier than just to let go? Doing stuff is hard. You know, cooking, washing the dishes, washing your clothes, oh, that's hard work. But just sitting in my room doing nothing, oh, that's just so easy. Is it? Should be. People always count on themselves as being lazy. You don't know how to be lazy. Look, I will teach you on this retreat how to be lazy. This is Lazy 101 course. Because people don't... They don't know how to be lazy. They're sitting in there studying themselves, you know, outside the kitchen this morning, thinking about stuff, planning it. Even when you're supposed to be doing nothing, you're still doing stuff. I was so surprised when somebody, a friend of mine, they were doing well in their business, in their family, so they went on a holiday to Club Med, I think in Bali or somewhere. And they showed me what they did in Club Med in Bali. You know, breakfast at a certain time, then playing tennis, then go scuba diving, then having lunch by the beach, and then after the beach, doing windsurfing, and then more tennis in the afternoon, and the evening, sort of a big disco dancing, till about 10 o'clock at night. And I said, why, that's jam-packed. You must be so tired after coming back from holiday. Say, yeah, we're exhausted. What a crazy life that is. Or, you may go on holiday, go to Europe. And what do? Traveling around here, traveling around there, and of course, doing shopping. And that is something which I could never understand at all. I was in London recently, had all these Australians going to London, to Oxford Street and places like that to do shopping. And all the English were coming to Australia to do shopping. And there's a disconnect there. Especially Singaporeans. Singaporeans, they come on retreat here, but they always leave a day early to go to Perth to do shopping. You got it. And what do Australians do when they go to Singapore? Shopping. So there's some insights I just haven't penetrated yet, and that's one of them. I just don't get it. There are shops in Singapore, there are shops in Australia, and these are all franchised. You can go any place, you get whatever you want. You don't have to go overseas to get Singapore goods. You don't have to go to Australia to get sort of stuffed kangaroo and get that in sort of London. What are people doing this for? So anyway, there's some insights which I don't really get, but what I do get is that if you really want to have a bit of a rest, don't do so much. Holidays. It's interesting, isn't it? Why is it when it's a holiday people want to go somewhere else? They spend all this money in their house. They spend all this money getting the perfect bed And look, honestly, even here, the bed in your house, in your bedroom, is never as comfortable as the one in home, in your own bedroom. It's the best bed in the world. It is your home, paid all that money for it, and as soon as you've got time to enjoy it, what do? Go somewhere else. Absolutely crazy. So, if I was a lay person, if I was on holiday, it's 2 weeks holiday, where are you going? I'm staying at home. Doing nothing. Okay, yeah, you don't have to cook, you can always go and eat out. But at least you can go back home. And you have your own bed, your own place to really enjoy. Oh, you go to the washroom. All the money you spend on airfares, you can actually hire a cook and a maid for 2 weeks to do all the housework for you. And that way you can stay at home without doing anything. You can even, for all that money you spend going overseas in big hotels, you can hire somebody to actually give you a foot massage, you know, in your own home. So it's really nice. Whatever you want to do, it's really nice. So anyway, I can't understand why people travel around the world to go to places. So anyway, it's really because we're so restless. When it's time we can actually do nothing, we have to do something. They always ask you, what are you doing for Christmas time? Doing nothing. Oh, then come and help me, I'm moving. So that is why, if you really want to be lazy, don't say that word, I'm doing nothing, because people think that means you're free to help them. So, I've had that inside a long time. When people ask, what am I doing? You know, to get out of, you know, getting called up to help somebody, because we're supposed to be compassionate, fair enough. If I am just out there having a cup of tea, I say I'm not doing nothing, I'm actually doing something. I'm watching the trees grow. That's one of my great excuses. So if somebody is at, you know, if you're out there having a cup of tea and Bianca asks you to, you know, come and give a hand with the washing up or something, say, no, sorry, I'm busy. I'm watching the trees grow. Because the trees do grow. They do grow, you know. But you've got to be very patient to see them grow. You just turn away for 1 second and they grow. You missed it. So, what are you doing when you're sitting down here? Are you doing anything? I'm trying to watch my breath. I'm trying to get limiters. There's only 2 days left. I've got to make some progress. How many times have I told you that's not the way to meditate? You just sit here and see what happens. Now watch the neurons grow in your brain or whatever else is growing. You know, what? Just, you know, watch your hair grow on your chin or something, you know, if you're a girl. Something which is really totally impossible. But still, it's actually learning how to do absolutely nothing. Or rather, nothing doing. Learn how to be still. And after a while in meditation, you see, this is the insight into this. Why is it we can't just be still? Why do we always have to do stuff? And the answer is, I'll tell you the answer, but you'll find it out for yourself, is the stronger your sense of self, the more you have to do stuff. Big people got big egos, they never have any rest. They always have to be doing something. Because when they do something, they exist. That's the person they used to, the great achiever. But to achieve nothing, that really challenges who we think we are. To be able to come on this retreat and actually make absolutely no progress, if you can do that on these 9 days and feel so content with it, that means your sense of self is almost gone. For those of you who feel so disappointed, oh, 9 days, I've got nowhere, I was just more stupid than when I came. Exactly, you are stupid. Because you're measuring and thinking you're going to get something out of this retreat. You're not going to get anything out of this retreat, I told you at the very beginning, you're going to lose a lot, but not gain. The only thing you're going to gain on this retreat is probably weight. Because you're eating too much because the food is too good. That's one of my problems. I put on weight, and the reason is because I read this in many medical magazines. If you worry a lot, you lose weight. I don't worry at all. That means I don't worry about anything. So So that's why, you know, I need to go to worry classes to teach me how to worry and be anxious. And if I could do that, I could lose some weight. I can't worry about anything. Well, what happens then? What have you got to worry about? You're going to die anyway. If you die quickly, again, that's wonderful because you don't have to waste so much time in old people's homes. An extra year of life. It'd be great if an extra year of life was added now. But any extra years of life for eating health food and exercising, you only get that at the end of your life and you can't really enjoy it. Adding extra years onto your life, is that really such a good idea? Oh, I get into a lot of trouble. But anyway, why can't we just let go? So learning how to have a little sense of non-self when you start meditating. Use that insight to help you let go. So, I'm now going to introduce a nice little technique which I was been developing, and it's really helpful. You know, maybe you can remember when you were at school, if you haven't done any acting since. I remember at school, primary school, grade one or grade two, the teacher said, pretend you're a tree. You put your arms out, swaying in the wind. And you really got into it. You know, you thought you were a tree, swaying in the wind. And then you get sort of other acting, you know, when you're sort of, you're doing Shakespeare or Hamlet or something. You really get into the roles. And I've noticed that everyone can do some type of acting. And when you start to act, you actually almost sometimes become that person. There was a book I read, I never saw the movie obviously, but there was a book called Awakenings by Oliver Sacks. Many of you may have known, I read the book, it was amazing. There was these people who had this disease, a virus, you know, 20 years previously. They were in a coma for 20 years. And he gave this medication. They suddenly came out of the coma. 20 years they'd been unable to speak or say anything or do anything. And they came this clarity for a few moments. And so they made a movie out of this. And I think it was, if I remember the article, was Robert De Niro was playing one of these patients. And he's apparently a really great actor. And he was getting so into the role of being one of these patients in a coma with this disease that it's frightened the hell out of Oliver Sacks, who was a consultant. Frightened him so much because this actor was starting to exhibit symptoms which he'd never been told about of a person with that disease. He was actually becoming that disease. He got so into character. The things which he didn't know, he would have never been told, but Oliver Sacks recognized. And he told him, lay off a little bit. You're getting too much into the role. You're actually becoming that sickness. And I think I can understand how that works, because the power of the mind to imagine and the imagination creating the reality in the body is really, really powerful, especially if you're a trained actor. So how I wanted to use that is I ask people, and you can try this next time you sit down to meditate and role play. Sit down, close your eyes and imagine you're the Buddha. Go for broke. Imagine you're the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree. And really get into the role as much as you possibly can. A Buddha, no desires, no ill will, no craving. Doesn't need to do anything anymore, already enlightened, already got to the pinnacle of all achievements, doesn't need to do anything ever again. You can really relax and let it be, because you've got nothing to achieve, nowhere to go. This is your last life, so just watch the trees grow. So when you start to imagine you're the Buddha sitting down here, you actually get into the role of it. And after a while, you don't actually become the Buddha, but you get a bit close. And then after, you know, you've imagined you're the Buddha for 5 minutes, then watching your breath is easy. You've got this huge leap in meditation, simply because, just like Robert De Niro, he was trying to imagine he was one of these patients, And there were some symptoms of that disease he was never taught about. He started to manifest. There's some aspects of a Buddha you haven't really penetrated yet will come up simply because the mind is fantastic to imagine these things and you're peaceful and calm. Wow. Such a simple thing. But what it does, it knows the insight of just how powerful the mind is. So in order to let go, you imagine you're enlightened. You imagine you're a Buddha. And just go for it and see what happens. Great little insight technique of how to give your meditation a boost. But it's all because you do stuff because you think you're not enlightened, because you have to do something to get enlightened. Here you imagine you're already enlightened, so you don't have to do anything. Woohoo! So those are some insights in just the, how to meditate. And when you get into the deeper meditation, it's a good time I mentioned this little technique now. When you get into the deeper meditations, I'm talking about the nimitta, and some of you get nimittas. Nimittas, sometimes they come up and they disappear again, and sometimes they come there and they don't develop, they just stay there for a long time, you want them to get deeper, and it's so, so difficult because if you try and give yourself any instructions, it all falls apart, you have to be really still in those stages. So you say, Ajahn Brahm said about the still forest pool, and as soon as you think that, you start thinking and the whole thing gets destroyed. So there's one insight which I got from my meditation, because sometimes I was meditating, and you get to a blockage in the meditation. If I try and examine that blockage, especially in the deep states, it just is too disturbing. You can't think. If you do think, then you've lost your stillness. But then every now and again, an idea would come up, almost from nowhere, even subverbally, and I could see the obstacle and go past it. And later I said, where did that idea come from? Because I like to examine things, that's insight, examining afterwards once the data is in. And I realised actually that was what Ajahn Chah taught me, years and years and years and years ago. And I thought I'd forgotten it. A little statement which he made was actually lodged like a seed, waiting for the rain to fall before it germinated. Years, 20, 30 years. And that's what I realized, just how this mind works and how you can program it. That was Ajahn Chah programming me, putting the idea in, and when it was needed, then it came up. So I started doing that to myself, noticing that when you get into deep meditations, the mind is too subtle to even give any instructions at all. So I thought, why not I try Ajahn Chah method? I will give myself instructions at the very beginning of meditation. And that's where I came and developed the what I call these days programming your mindfulness. So, for example, if you do get a nimitta and it just disappears straight away, then you're pretty sure it's because, you get involved, you get a bit excited, you try and do something with it. Then I told myself, beginning of the meditation, good chance a nimitta will come up. So, if a nimitta comes up, I'll just leave it be. Nimitta comes up, I'll leave it be. Nimitta comes up, I'll leave it be. I gave myself instructions in my own words 3 times, as clear instructions as I could possibly give, because if you've got a worker and you don't give them clear instructions, how can you expect them to do the job? Like the case of one of the nuns in England. She was being driven to the airport, I think from Amrawati, and her driver, an anagarika, was not giving accurate instructions. Because apparently what happened, they were coming to a roundabout, and the nun said, go straight ahead at the roundabout. And this anagarika had so much faith in the nuns, the anagarika would do anything the nun said. So when they got to the roundabout, they went right up the middle, over the centre and down the other side. You said, go straight ahead to the roundabout. That actually happened. That's what you told me to do. So I've got to be careful when I'm in the passenger seat giving instructions, the GPM, the Global Positioning Monk. Then I tell them, just, you can go straight ahead at the lights once they turn green. Be very precise. Otherwise, well, you told me to go through the red light. I thought you'd protect us. You've got powers. So you have to give very clear instructions to your mind so they cannot be misunderstood. Three times, and just listen with as much mindfulness attention as you possibly can. And then afterwards, you don't just forget it. Because I know it's in the mind. It's lodged there somewhere. And so when I get to that stage, the nimitta is there, and I want to get involved to develop them. Something inside says, no, leave them alone. And I know where that came from. Subverbal, don't need to disturb the mind because the job was done at the beginning where the mind wasn't so sensitive. And when you get to that stage, there's no problem. You just go past the problem. So whatever obstacles and difficulties you have in meditation, especially the ones in the deep stages, look, to get into jhanas, that is scary stuff. Simply because you really have to let go of who you think you are. You really just have to vanish. And that's one of the most terrifying things for a human being, to disappear. So, what do you do when you come to that stage? You get bright nimittas, but you can't take them further. You know, begin the meditation. You give yourself instructions. When the nimitta is really strong, I'll disappear. Nimitta strong, I'll disappear. Nimitta strong, I'll disappear. Now, those are my words. You do your own words. What you think is a problem. And then you get to that stage where you normally get stuck. And then what happens? The thought, the idea, all subverbal because it's too subtle to actually have a real thought. And then I'll disappear. So you just let go and just go into the jhanas. It overcomes the obstacles. But if you try and do something there, that will never get deep. So you have all these different insights as you go in meditation of how meditation works and how to overcome those obstacles. And you find that after a while, you use that insight and meditation becomes so powerful because you are now using wisdom power, not willpower. Willpower is, to me, it's absolutely stupid, counterproductive. To me, willpower is like you come to a blockage in your meditation. You come to the brick wall. And what do people do? They literally bang their head against the brick wall. What's that story? That some American went to Jerusalem and they went to the Wailing Wall and they saw this, you know, what the Jewish people do, you know, hitting their head against Wailing Wall. And the American asked the guy, apparently it's a true story, he asked the guy, you know, what are you doing? He said, I'm praying to God for world peace. Are you succeeding? No, he said. It's like hitting my head against the brick wall. And that's exactly what he was doing. Maybe that's where hitting the head against the brick wall comes from the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. Anyway, that's what happens in meditation. You get these blockages, and it is like you use willpower. And it's absolutely stupid, because all you need to do is to step back a bit, and you'll find to the right. The wall ends. There's no wall further. You can just walk around it. Or to the left. There's a door. Or a ladder. So when you get wisdom, you see the bigger picture. You don't need to keep banging your head and giving yourself a headache. Now use the door. I remember somebody showed me this. It was a news clip. I think the Australian government had built a refugee centre somewhere in South Australia. So this big refugee centre. And they showed the clip with this big high-tech gate, you know, with electric wires and electric and razor wire and big sentries. But unfortunately, the Australian government ran out of money, so they couldn't complete the rest of the fence. All there was a gate. The other fence hadn't been built yet. So. It was a gate without a fence. Only governments could do stuff like that. So... that's what it's like in meditation. You come across the gate, but you realize just to the left, that's where the fence ends. So you just go around it. No problem whatsoever. Use wisdom power. Never willpower. Never use your force. Force just makes you more tense. Just stare back. What's going on? I know you, Mara. I can see what's going on. Controlling. wanting expectations is one of the biggest problems for people, especially when a monk like me comes along and starts talking about jhanas. Wow. As soon as I mention jhanas, bliss better than sex, amazing stuff. What happens? I want. And so sometimes people tell me off, says, you don't talk about jhanas. But then if I don't talk about them, I get into trouble for hiding the Dhamma. So yeah, you've got to talk about them, explain them. But now you know what they are. Please don't try and get them. Instead, the causes of the jhanas. They're just stages of letting go, deep stages of you disappearing. So you have to disappear. You have to be peaceful. The greatest teaching of Ajahn Chah, actually probably, if all of his teaching, oh no, there's actually another one which, okay, I'll tell you the other one after this one. One of his great teachings, again, first year when I was a monk. And he, like Ajahn Chah, he would have these stories and he'd keep repeating them, just like I do. I follow my teacher when I repeat my stories. But then, you know, he'd sort of move on to another story. So the stories would have maybe a lifespan of maybe a month or 2 months, and then new ones would come. But, you know, usually the old ones would be repeated. But this one was never, ever repeated. I only heard this in my first couple of months with Ajahn Chah, and he never said it again. And I forgot it too, because when I heard it, I thought it was ridiculous. I could not understand it at all. And I didn't have very much faith in him then, so I didn't think, oh, this is really deep. I thought it was just stupid. So that was the story of his monastery being the mango orchard. It was a mango orchard simile. He said that his monastery was a mango orchard and the mango trees had been planted by the Buddha. And because of the great compassion and wisdom of the Buddha, the mango trees are still here today, and every mango tree has got thousands of the ripest, sweetest, juiciest mangoes you've ever tasted. Full of mangoes. And I like mangoes, especially the, you know, when they're ripe. They're just about coming to be ripe here in Australia, but the, you know, the real juicy ones haven't yet arrived, but they're coming soon. And I like mangoes. And usually I don't take much fruit. Over in the monastery, I call that, don't mention fruit, that's the F word. only to annoy my fellow monks, give them a hard time. But mangoes are great. But he said, you cannot climb the tree to get the mango. You just can't reach them. You shake the tree, and the mangoes just will not fall. You know, you get a ladder, but the ladder is not high enough to reach the mangoes. So you try and throw a stick up, what most people did in those days, throw a stick up to get the mango to fall. Still, it will not fall. He said, there's only one way to get that mango. You have to sit perfectly still under the tree and open up your hand and a mango will fall. That was his simile. Now, how ridiculous can you be? I know mango trees. I've sat under them. None have ever fallen. And if they did, you know where they fall usually, on your head. Really bad luck. The birds get them before they fall. So I thought that was a ridiculous simile and I just put it aside. I thought I'd forgotten it until the meditation started to take off and you started to see that how absolutely true that was. And how just great, great, great teaching. Sadhu, sadhu, Ajahn Chah. When you move, we've tried to shake the Bodhi tree to get so one, stream meaning once returning, non-returning. If you try and shake the tree to get that, no way. You waste your time. Climb the tree, get ladders, get cherry pickers to try and get those mangoes. However you try and figure it out, it never works. You never get jhanas, you never get nimittas when you're trying so hard. You tried that for the last few days, for goodness sake. There's nothing wrong with you, it's just the method is wrong. So instead just sit perfectly still. Open your heart, the hand. And then mangoes will fall. Because that's what happens. Absolutely counterintuitive. That's why so many people don't get enlightened. They're trying too hard. You sit here perfectly still, Open up your hand, your heart, and all this man goes full. Nimittas, gorgeous nimittas. Jhanas, you don't do anything. You're just sitting there perfectly still, and they plop into your heart. Stream winning, once returning, all that stuff. Plop. And there it is. But why me? I didn't do anything. Plop, there comes another one. Because that is actually how this path works. Brilliant, beautiful simile of Ajahn Chah. So the last simile before I finish off, because I was on Ajahn Chah now. The old personal simile. Because it is true, one of the reasons I give these talks, because if they really grab you and they really get inspired, it's not just giving you information, but you know, afterwards your meditation is really beautiful. Every time Ajahn Chah would give a really deep talk, you know, you really feel like, wow, it's so obvious, it's so easy, and you get so inspired. You meditate afterwards, and again, it's just so easy. That's why inspire yourself before you meditate. Don't just sit there, you go, oh, I don't want nothing else to do, I suppose, I just might as well meditate. No, inspire yourself. Think of some great teaching. Go and see the Buddha statue. Actually, inside those stupas, they're beautiful Buddha statues. Absolutely gorgeous. Go in there and just have, don't touch them, otherwise you might find true love. Go and see them and just get inspired. And get inspired by the place and just how much effort and charity has gone into building this place. And get yourself nice and inspired, and then you go sit down. Oh, it's so easy meditating once you're inspired. So that's what happened to me this time. Ajahn Chah came and gave a really nice talk at monastery. Honestly, with all good respect to this great teacher, he was often really boring. Often you sit there for 3 or 4 hours and think, what a lot of rubbish. And it was mostly rubbish. But every now and again, you get the beautiful nuggets of gold, the beautiful diamond in all that other stuff. And it was worth it. But this day, he was really on song. You know, we had his act together and just, wow, great talk. And the reason why he came to give this talk, that he was going off to have a sauna in our monastery. Ajahn Chah started getting sick. And we Western monks, you know, had this really good idea. Sometimes you do have great ideas. Not all the time, mostly stupid ideas. But sometimes, you know, one of them turns out, maybe just by luck, to be a good one. He said, let's build him a sauna. And quite frankly, maybe it was about 30% out of compassion, 70% selfishness. Because if we built him a sauna in our monastery, he'd have to come and visit. And it worked absolutely perfectly. We built the sauna. The first monastery I knew of in Thailand, which had a sauna, we built him a sauna, a very simple one, and he would come every week to try and get healthy. Didn't work, but you know, it worked for us. Because he would come and always give a Dharma talk before he had his sauna. And so this time he gave a brilliant Dharma talk. And oh, you know, you are flying. There's so much bliss and wisdom from him. And usually you go and help your teacher. But this time I thought, no, I'm going to go around the back of the hall, a quiet place, and just sit down and meditate. And oh, just such a juicy meditation after inspiration. Oh, it's wonderful. And you don't know how long. You don't watch clocks when you get a nice meditation. You came out afterwards. And the first thought, like gratitude for your teacher. So I thought, you know, maybe, you know, who knows, I might be able to do a service for him. So I walked over towards the sauna. But then I realized I was too late. Because I saw him come in the opposite direction. With, I think, 2 Thai people, the drivers. We're going to take him back to his monastery. He finished the sauna. I'd been meditating a couple of hours. He'd finished. So, we were going to cross on the path. And as I came closer, you can see Ajahn Chah looking at you. He came closer, and I realized what he was up to. He could see, you know, when you've had a really nice meditation, a really deep one, he could actually see. And this time, I never resisted him reading my mind. I was actually quite proud of my mind. It's actually good for a change. Just come out of a nice meditation. Come on, have a look. And honestly, you can, when somebody's reading your mind, you can feel they're getting inside. I don't know how it works, but you know, and he's having a look inside. So come and have a look. And he saw it was quite a beautiful mind for a change. And so he screwed up his face and he looked at me. And he said, Brahma Wangsa. Why? And he was actually really forceful. Why? Tamai in Thai. And I realized that he was really trying to enlighten me. He had a very peaceful mind. He wanted that last little kick to push me into being an arahant. And I replied, I don't know. Remember, I was a graduate from a great university. So utterly stupid. I don't know. Now the marvellous things with great monks and great nuns is they never scold you. They never get a stick and beat you and say, you stupid idiot. How many times have I been teaching you? You should know the answer by now. Whenever you're absolutely ridiculous and stupid, they just burst out laughing. Myself and many of the other Western monks, we were so stupid, we created so much laughter for our teacher. I think that's the reason why he had Western monks as a source of constant laughter for him. Who needs a comedy show when you've got Western monks? But then, after finishing laughing, he got serious again. He looked at me again. Brahma Wangsa, he said. And of course, I was really paying full attention. Now, personal teaching from a great master. He said, I will tell you the answer. And that really made me excited. I was going to get an answer, personal teaching from a great monk. The answer to one of the deepest questions ever. Why? I thought, wow, I better pay attention. And he said, the answer is... Are you paying attention? You know the answer anyway because you've read it in the books. But when I tell this to people who have never ever heard this before, they're just really listening. I'll tell you the answer, he said. But Wangsa, there's nothing. There's nothing. Mind me, all right. There's nothing. And then still looking at me, he said, do you understand? And I said, yes. He said, no, you don't. And he walked away. And I felt stupid before. Now I felt mega stupid. But at least, it put something in my mind for later on. Why? It's nothing. Do you understand? No, you don't. Sadhu. Okay, that's the insight talk for today. Oh, great stories. Okay, so have a wonderful day. I hope you're inspired. If you are inspired, just go and stretch your legs a bit and then come back and really get into it. Who knows? But remember, sit perfectly still. Open up your heart and see what happens. But if you say, oh, I did that, but nothing happened. You wanted again. You weren't still. It's just expectations again. So be perfectly still. Perfectly. Okay.